Hello listeners and welcome to episode 9 of Sportspiel. It's out with the old and in with the new. The world of athletics has said goodbye to two greats of the sport in the last couple of weeks, namely Usain Bolt and Mo Farah. Virgin Media and Corn Mints advertising will never be the same again. While two of the kings of athletics move on to pastures new, we are left to mourn the fact that the best adverts out there at the moment include Mauro Itoje sat next to the Talking Vitality Dog, Joe Root sat next to the Talking Vitality Dog, and Alistair Brownlee bullying brother Johnny in Aldi adverts because Johnny consistently coming second to his elder sibling wasn't painful enough. Oh, and Jessica Ennis-Hill has also sat next to the Talking Vitality Dog. Where are the quality advertisements, people? Usain Bolt simultaneously ironing, cooking, and pretending to be a baby in one house that was linked up with Virgin Media is gold dust. Farah telling me how important it was to eat my tasty corn, perfect. That's the real loss here. Athletics may struggle to replace the pair, but where is the new sporting acting talent? But anyway, joining me, Alistair Hooper, as always to chat all things sport, is someone who has plenty of acting talent. It's Mr. Will Moulton.
Good afternoon, my friends. I'll have you know that actually I have done a lot of acting in my time, but I've seemed to have played a lot of inanimate objects, including a puppet in The Sound of Music, one half of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the actual car, and Audrey 2, the plant from The Little Shop of Horrors. Not the voice, just the movements.
So that's an iconic role, though. A bit heart and soul into it.
It was hard work. I did have a good set of abs after that.
Yeah. Well, I was once Toto in The Wizard of Oz, but they wouldn't let me walk on all fours because they were worried about the damage it would do to my back.
How old were you?
I think I must have been about 7. But that was a big role for me.
Woof, woof.
In our first segment today, our sports discussion section, we're going to have a little chit-chat about some of the sports stories over the past couple of weeks. First up, we'll have some athletics chat as two legends bowed out of the sport, and Botswanan Isaac Makwala was barred from running because he had the norovirus. Or did he? After that, we'll look at the return of the Premier League and ask if the art of defending is categorically dead. And finally, we'll look at Scotland and Wales' recent success in their Euro hockey games. In our feature interview segment, we are joined by a snowboarder who is rapidly making a name for herself. At just 19, Katie Ormerod already has X Games medals and a World Cup title to her name. And she chats about the upcoming Winter Olympics, returning from her fractured back, what makes Yorkshire folk tick, and having to sign autographs in the gym. All that and more on Sportsbill. Anyway, let's race right into topic number one on this episode.
See what you did there?
And thank you. If for some reason this has managed to bypass you this week, the IAAF World Championships were held in London over the last week and a bit. Britain managed to reach 6 medals, their initial target, with 2 golds coming our way thanks to Mo Farah's 10,000 metre victory and the amazing 4x100 metre win, which never ever happens. But we're not going to discuss that right now because we've got 3 very important topics to cover from the championships, namely Mo Farah, Usain Bolt versus Justin Gatlin, and Isaac Makwala and that old farce. But first, Mo Farah, whose track career came to an end this championships with 10,000 metre gold and 5,000 metre silver. He's a 4-time Olympic champion and he will depart to focus on the marathon distance, but first off, what a career.
Yeah, he's an absolute legend, not just of British sport, but of world athletics in general. What he's done, he was unbeaten in major races from winning silver in the Daegu 10,000 in 2011 to finishing second in the 5,000 here. You know, he's unbelievable. He's done the double Olympics and
yes,
triple double at Worlds, and it's just all double.
It's quite a resume.
He's been fantastic, and it's a shame to see him stepping away from these events. But he's also going to go to the marathon, so there's no reason why in 2020 we won't see him on the top of the rostrum for Team GB after the marathon. So it's plenty still to look forward to.
But, and I have but double underlined on my notes. Farah, after the championships, he came out and accused sections of the media of trying to destroy his legacy. He said, "So many times you guys have been unfair to me. The fact is, I've achieved what I have from hard work, putting my balls on the line year after year and delivering for my country. Now this all relates to his relationship with his coach Alberto Salazar, who's still currently under investigation by the US Anti-Doping Agency. Both he and Farah deny they've ever broken the rules, and Farah has never, ever failed the drugs test. Is it a fair comment from Farah?
I think it's fair. We know, but we also know as trainee and young journalists ourselves, you want to, as a journalist, you want to ask the difficult questions because you want to get more of a juicy, interesting story, and you know you want to make money and have your own scoop. So you know, I can see why those people have been asking those questions, and they're right to. But also, there's never been any conclusive proof that Salazar has actually taken drugs. So why should we just assume that Farah is? I think the way he's sometimes been portrayed, it's been assuming he's guilty without any evidence. And I like to think of, you know, we see these athletes, and I like to take the naive view and think of them as innocent until proven otherwise. So I can see why they've done it. I just think maybe it's a little bit harsh, and we need to have more of a focus on what a fantastic person and what a fantastic servant he's been to British athletics and world athletics.
That's the thing. Journalists have a right to answer those questions, I think, because that's essentially their job. So long as their written pieces following are based on fact and not based on speculation and rumour, and I think there's been a few occasions where some pieces have gone out and it's not been totally based on fact. So I don't see a problem with the questions. Or what Farah kind of crosses the line for me is that he doesn't seem willing to accept any questions whatsoever coming his way, and that's the issue I have.
I think in athletics at the moment, if you're an athlete, you have to be prepared to answer questions about doping, because that is, you know, where the main headlines are in athletics. So you know, I think he's not been particularly gracious with the way he's had to answer some of the questions. Of course, you're going to be sick about having to answer them all the time, but do what Usain Bolt does, you know, sort of laugh them off, or when you need to be serious, but face up to those questions and just keep proving your innocence. If you are innocent, well, you can prove your innocence. And just, you know, what I don't like is that Farah didn't do any questions in the lead up, didn't do anything in the lead up before these champs, and I felt that was unfair on the fans, because the fans, forget about the journalists, but the fans love and idolise Mo Farah. You know, he's loved by so many people across the world and across Britain, kids and parents and grandparents. Everyone loves Mo Farah, and no one takes any notice because we all want him to be clean and innocent. We're just going to forget the fact he's got these accusations flying around. And I felt like he had a duty to them to answer just some questions about how he was feeling, how much he was looking forward to performing in front of a fantastic crowd. And it was such a shame that he refused to answer those questions. And for me, that was a bit of that sort of put a blot on my coffee book for Farah, in that perhaps he's maybe not quite the nice guy he comes out to be. And I can see why he didn't want to do any questions, but I feel like he should have just refused to have done any questions about doping or anything like that, and just answer questions about his life, the world championship, fun questions, fan orientated questions. He should have done something along those lines.
That's a sad indictment of where the sport of athletics is right now, because the trust is gone between the viewing public, and they can't believe what happens on the track anymore. So if you're an athlete at the centre of all that, you kind of have to just deal with it.
Well, if you look at the comments surrounding the Ethiopian Ayana, who won the women's 5 and 10,000 metre double, and you know, produced that world record in Rio, there's a lot of accusations on social media, and saying she can't, you know, she can't be A, she can't be 20, and B, also she can't be going that fast naturally. She's got to be taking drugs, and there are questions coming up about the Ethiopian drug enforcement team. Apparently, after Kenya and Jamaica and Argentina and all those recently, Ethiopia are next to come under the major scrutiny. So we could still be seeing a story develop there. But I think I like to take the naive view, as I've said. I like to, even with athletes who've previously been banned, like Justin Gatlin, they're there competing at the moment, which means they haven't been found guilty of doping in a while. So I like to think that they're innocent until proved guilty.
The idea is
when I watch them. That's what I like to think. It might be childish and naive, but you know.
Well. I'll say nothing more. But with a new distance, he's going on to marathon running now. He's got a new name. He now wants to be Mohamed Farah.
I don't know how much of it that was his decision, or how much of it was a sponsor's decision, but you know, whatever he's called, he's still going to be loved, isn't he? Mohamed Farah, Farah, I don't care. Exactly. As long as he races hard, tries his best and wins medals, does it really matter what he's called?
Exactly. But on to another departing legend, a certain Usain Bolt. And his farewell didn't exactly stick to the dream Hollywood script, such as sport. The Jamaican sprinter pulled up in the 4x100 metres with injury and couldn't finish, but perhaps the event that hit people hardest was the fact that he came third in the 100 metres, and arch nemesis and the people's enemy himself, Justin Gatlin, came first. Now, first things first, whatever happened at these championships, Bolt's legendary status was never going to be diminished. And again, what a career that guy's had.
It's amazing what he's done, the triple and the winning medals there. Oh no, he didn't have the treble actually because of Nestor Carter's.
But yes, take it away.
Retrospective doping ban. But you know, he's a legend of the sport and off the track as well. I was actually slightly overshadowed by Hero the Hedgehog at these games.
That Hedgehog.
It was fantastic. But you know what? He just comes across as a lovely man. He's serious when he needs to be, but he mucks around. He has a joke. Looks like he's having fun. He loves the British crowd, which always helps, you know. And he's just a fantastic role model for the sport. It's a shame to see him go, but I'm sure we'll see him around doing something.
Media related,
promotional or something.
Yeah. So. And I love Usain Bolt. I'm going to miss him on the track because he has confidence in himself, but he uses the confidence in the right way. Definitely the right way. Unlike someone, say, Nicholas Bettner, who springs to mind, who didn't use his confidence in the right way, and Cristiano Ronaldo to a certain extent as well, because he's never really endeared himself to the public. But on to party pooper Gatlin. Were the crowd right to boo his victory?
I don't know. It's a tough one. I was in the stadium the night after for the medal ceremony, and there were a few boos, but it was largely drowned out. I had chosen not to do anything myself because I don't think Gatlin should be in the sport having served two drugs ban. But the fact is, he's there. At the moment, we've got to assume he's innocent and he's not doping. And he beat Bolt fair and square, so I can see why people booed him. He is a bit of a villain, but he's not the only one out there competing that has previously served a drugs ban. So, you know, if you're going to boo Gatlin, boo everyone. You could even boo, slightly different circumstances, but Luvo Manionga, the South African who won the long jump, he served a drugs ban for taking and getting addicted to a form of crystal meth, which has some properties that can enhance performance. He was taking that though because of poverty and financial hardship, not because he was trying to enhance his performance, but he still served a drugs ban. If you're going to go on that, you've got to be consistent and boo all of them, haven't you?
Exactly. And one thing I will throw out there is that Justin Gatlin's first ban was a little bit iffy because he was banned for, it was a medication that he was taking since he was 9 years old for ADHD. The second ban is a bit of a farce because that is the testosterone gel that he claimed was rubbed into his leg by a masseuse without him realising. But
it's not the funniest doping story though, is it? LeSean Merritt has that one.
Yes, LeSean Merritt, who was coincidentally was also at these championships.
Was he banned in 2003 for buying a penis enlargement drug that also had some form of banned substance in it?
Yeah, we've all been there, obviously. But yeah, that's the thing with the booing. If you're going to boo, be consistent. I know Justin Gatlin's become the poster boy for everything that is wrong, but there are a lot of other athletes out there, LeSean Merritt, like we mentioned, Johan Blake, Dawn Harper,
Shirley-Ann Fraser-Pryce. You know, she contests her drug ban back in 2005-2006, but she's still been done for drugs, and she's loved worldwide.
Exactly. But back to Bolt briefly, and my favourite stat of his is that of the 30 quickest 100 metre times of all time, only 9 were done by a clean athlete, and all 9 of those were Usain Bolt. So it's going to be a bit of a vacuum in the sport once he's gone, but Andre de Grasse, Wade van Niekerk are two potential rising stars that could help fill that void.
It was a shame that Grasse wasn't there at these champs. I think he would have done really, really well. He's an exciting talent. Seems like a fairly approachable guy off the track. Van Niekerk was fantastic. Silver medal in the 200, gold in the 400. Didn't do himself justice, though, in terms of the way he reacted after that 200 medal, because he was claiming about a conspiracy against him, the whole Isaac Mukwala thing. And I think he was sort of slightly making that up. I mean, it was obviously in the papers and stuff, but the fact is, he came out and he beat Mukwala in the 200. He won the silver medal. The crowd love Van Niekerk. You know, he's a major star now. And whatever, you know, the papers were saying, he should have been more appreciative of the London crowd, because the London crowd loved him. They gave him a huge cheer. They gave Mukwala a huge cheer as well, because that's because of his story. And the London crowd, all they wanted to do was see Wade Van Niekerk do well, and they loved him, and they're a knowledgeable crowd. And I think he should have been more gracious, and just, you know, I can understand why he was upset, but he should have focused on the positives and, you know, thanked the crowd for being behind him as much as they were.
Yeah, but on to Isaac Mukwala, lovely little link there. The Botswanan, if they somehow missed you, you missed it. Botswanan 200 metre and 400 metre runner, there was neurovirus broke out at the championships that struck down around 30 athletes, and it was thought that Mukwala was one of those who had been suffering. And I think he did in fact vomit while coming off of a coach at some point, but he was subsequently barred by the IAAF from competing in the 400 metre final because they thought he had neurovirus, but he said he was fine, and a day later he was then allowed to race a solo time trial to qualify for the 200 metre semi-final. Great video to watch. Really strange seeing one guy run around the Olympic Stadium.
Yes, it was very weird.
And as soon as he crossed the line, of course, he met the time that got him qualified to the semi-final. He did a few press-ups after the line to let the IAAF know that he was, in fact, fit and healthy. Got to the semi-final, got through to the final, and finished sixth overall in the 200 metres. But the real loss for everyone, both Mukwala and the viewing public, is that he missed out on that 400 metre final, because he was seen as the main rival to Van Niekerk for that gold medal.
Yeah, it was a massive shame he couldn't take part in that race. But I think the whole situation just proved that the IAAF didn't know what to do when a situation like this arose, which is ridiculous. You'd think they'd have all sorts of, you know, emergency plans in place, but they barred him of taking recommendations, not rules, but recommendations from Public Health England about a 48-hour quarantine. And, you know, to actually bar him from entering the stadium, to change his accreditation, was just a joke. And then you had the Botswanan team on the BBC saying, you know, they didn't really know what was going on, there hadn't been any official tests. The BBC then gave the right of reply to the IAAF, and the woman, whose name was Christine something, came on, got an absolute grilling, but to be fair, did really well, and sort of explained it, and almost admitted that they were just sort of, they hadn't prepared for this in a way. And it was a shame that we were robbed of seeing what could have been a great final. I think Van Niekerk still would have won, but Mukwala would have been there, and, you know, next time
there would have been a battle.
Next time, obviously, they'll know what to do. Yeah. And it was a shame, but I mean, it endeared Isaac Mukwala to the public. He became a household name, whereas he might not have been before. So,
we all wasn't all bad. Him now, yeah. So he can take that away from it.
Yeah,
if anything.
The Brits love him.
Exactly. He's a new fan favourite. We're on to discussion topic number two. And the English Premier League returned to action last weekend in its typically ridiculous style.
Yep.
Of the standout results from the opening fixtures, the eye catchers were the fact that reigning champions Chelsea got beaten by Burnley 3-2 at home. Arsenal kicked off their campaign by coming back from 3-2 down to win 4-3 against Leicester. And Liverpool threw away a lead at Watford to draw 3-3. Finally, on Sunday, Manchester United promptly demolished West Ham United 4-0, which made my decision to watch my team in a pub not a very good one. However, in amongst the madness, enough of your taunting, we're asking the question, has the art of defending in the league died a horrible death?
Yes.
It has, yes.
There you go. That's my answer. Come on, you've got three of our supposedly best teams, Chelsea, Arsenal and Liverpool, conceding three goals in 90 minutes to Burnley, Watford and Leicester.
Something
doesn't say a lot.
And that's why English clubs are so bad in Europe now. Because if you look back to, say, 2006 to 2010 period, where we were comfortably getting three sides into the semi-finals of the Champions League each year, it's because we had the top defenders and the top defences in the world at that point. You look at Ferdinand and Vidic, Terry and Carvalho. Those are elite.
Colo Torre is best.
Colo Torre is best.
Carragher,
yes.
And Hippier, or Carragher and Agger.
Yeah,
good defensive combination.
Another example. That's why we were good. And people were constantly asking, oh, why aren't they doing so well in Europe now? Because no one can defend. That is why.
I mean, it says a lot when Liverpool were currently playing Alberto Moreno as first choice left back.
Exactly.
And last point, that last year they were playing James Milner at left back. You know,
it's just become an afterthought. And you look at that, the Arsenal defence that ended that game against Leicester. They started with a back three, but then they reverted back to a back four. But at the end of the game, they had a right back playing left back, a left back playing centre back, another left back playing centre back, and a winger slash central midfielder playing at right back. That just sums it up.
Yeah, well, he had that 3-5-2 formation, didn't he, or 3-4-3, and then he changed it at Old Wenger. But to be fair, it worked in the end. So they did get two. They did get that late winner.
Oh yeah, but everyone's just overly obsessed with strikers at the moment. And for me, when I see a ton of 3-3s or 4-3s, 4-4 games, they stop becoming unique and exciting, and they end up becoming a joke and a little bit farcical when they're happening that regularly.
It was 31 goals on that opening weekend. I think that's the highest ever in the Premier League's history. Over 10 games, you know, average of 3 goals a game, but there was a 1-0 and a couple of 0-0s in there, so...
Yeah, well, bring back the 0-0s.
It's a shame.
And the 1-0s, that's what
I say. It's a shame because, you know, I'd love to see a 4-3 or a 5-4. Well, you want one of those a week, you don't want 3 or 4 of them a week.
Exactly, because then it just becomes ridiculous.
And boring.
And
quite often it's not skill. The goals aren't skillful, it's bad defending.
Exactly.
If it's, you know, 6-7 goals in the game and each is a world-class strike or world-class team build-up or something, yeah, that's what I want to see. I don't want to see one great strike and 6 goals that have got in because teams have given the ball away or conceding only goals and doing silly things with footballs.
Yeah, and that's why someone like Virgil van Dijk right now, defender, currently sort of on strike at Southampton, is so highly priced now and so in demand because there's so few people who can actually defend properly in the league right now. But away from that little discussion, and we come on to the final bit that we need to talk about today, and that is hockey with regards to Wales and Scotland and their Euro hockey events. At the weekend, they took part in the Euro Hockey Nations Championship Division B matches, which is a very catchy title, if I do say so myself.
Very catchy.
The men took part in their competition up in Glasgow, and the women competed in Cardiff. And some stuff happened, and I'm not really sure what happened, but here is Will to tell you.
As you know, I love my hockey, so I was following with keen interest. The men's tournament, we had, from the British perspective, Scotland and Wales both looking to get promoted to the top tier. In order to do that, they had to finish in the top two, and they were contesting the final, which was fantastic. Scotland eventually came away 4-3 winners in a really, really entertaining game, actually. And they won throughout the whole tournament, and this is a Scottish side that took part in the Hockey World League earlier this summer alongside the likes of Argentina, the Netherlands, England, and did quite well. There's still a lot of the players still part-time, so it was really, really exciting to see them do so well. And Wales as well, only got one player in the current GB setup, but you know, they also performed really, really well. We're unlucky to lose that final, wearing the lead a couple of times. It was a great game, and it was a shame that Wales women couldn't quite follow in the path as well, so they were obviously, as you said, on home soil. They went into the tournament not ranked particularly highly in terms of other teams around them, but on a 13-game unbeaten run on home soil, the confidence was high. They did well in the group stage. They thrashed Austria 6-1. They beat a good Poland side 1-0. They lost to Belarus 4-2, but they were still through to the semi-finals, where they unfortunately lost to Russia, and then they lost to Italy in the third, fourth playoff. But by that point, sort of, no one really cared because they'd gone knocked out. But it's the Wales women's squad is an exciting side. I've watched a lot more of them than I did the men's hockey because, you know, we've had Beth Bingo on the show. Beth had a fantastic tournament, playing really well in sort of that screen position in between defence and midfield. Really, really exciting young talent. Obviously, GB Academy player at the moment, so it was great to see her playing so well. As is Sarah Jones. Sarah Jones, part of the GB setup, played well. Phoebe Richards and Eloise Lacey up front, really good talent. Eloise Lacey, really good stick skills. Phoebe Richards has got insane pace. At the back, you had Tina Evans, who I've interviewed as well. Lovely lady, played really well. Leah Wilkinson, as Beth Fisher, the commentator, said, how she's never won a cap for GB, I'll never know, because she is an awesome, awesome defender. You've got Rose Thomas in goal, you know. This is a side that's still, again, like the men, it's part-time. But the fact is they're competing with teams, you know, who are full-time and they're doing well. They've risen up the ranking 6 places alone this year. They're the highest they've ever been in the world at 26. They're competing in Europe, they're competing on an international stage. It's really exciting time, and to have two tournaments hosted on home soil in Scotland and Wales, you know, not in England, promoting hockey in those countries, you know, is fantastic. We want to see more of them, we want to see more funding go towards those nations to get them up to professional status, to get them all up into the top tier. it's a really exciting time for British hockey at the moment, not just for England and GB, but for these other nations as well. The talent is in abundance. It's such a well-played sport, and finally now we're getting that talent through and producing some really, really good teams across the spectrum. So, exciting time for British hockey. England men and women and Scotland women taking part in their Euros this week. It'll be interesting to see how they do. England women obviously defending their title from 2015. Coming up against the Netherlands, it's going to be a fascinating, fascinating one, and I can't wait for that to get underway.
Oh, yes. And if you aim high, then eventually you will get to that level.
We want to see in the Euro Championships England, Scotland and Wales all in the same tier, and that's nearly happened now. If Scotland don't get relegated this time round, Wales get promoted in 2019, and all the men stay as they are. You know, I'm really, really excited for the future of British hockey. Rio 2016, I think, was just the start of how good it could be in this country.
Certainly the start of something good.
Definitely.
But that concludes this first segment on this episode of Sportspiel. But stick around, because, of course, we have our feature interview segment coming up after the break. And we are joined by 19-year-old snowboarder Katie Ormerod, who is certainly making a name for herself in the sport. She already has X Games medals and a World Cup title to her name. And she chats to us about the upcoming Winter Olympics, her aims for those, training regime, coming back from a fractured back as well. And also what makes Yorkshire individuals so good at sport. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back, everyone, to the feature interview section. And after hosting speed skater Charlotte Gilmartin 2 episodes ago, we're lucky enough to be joined by a second guest who will be eyeing up success at the upcoming Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. She's enjoyed a highly successful season and became the first ever British woman to win a Big Air World Cup. It's a very warm welcome to snowboarder Katie Ormerod. Many thanks for joining us, Katie. How is everything?
Everything's great, thank you.
Good stuff. Now, while I'm obviously a huge fan of doing audio interviews like this, there's one drawback with you, Katie, in that to fully appreciate the mental nature of your sport, you kind of need to see video evidence. And scrolling through your Twitter profile, some of the videos of you in training and the pictures of you flying through the air making all manner of shapes with a snowboard are pretty mind-boggling, to say the least. So I suppose I have to start by asking, how on earth do you find yourself involved in a sport like that? And how do you even find out that you have the talent for it?
Well, it all started back when I was only 5 years old, because my mum and dad were really keen snowboarders. So I'm lucky enough to live 10 minutes away from the local dry slope in Halifax. So I just started going there with my parents like every week. And I've been doing it literally since I literally can't remember not having snowboarding in my life, so I've just done it since I was tiny. Went every week because I really enjoyed it, and then it wasn't until I was about 14 years old that I won the British Championships in Switzerland and landed a trick called a backside 720 on the big jump, and the British team coach saw me and put me on the British team straight away, and then I've just been like travelling the world competing internationally ever since. So yeah, it's been pretty good so far.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it. But when I originally told some of my colleagues and friends that I was going to be interviewing you, a lot of them said that you must have experienced your fair share of injuries snowboarding. One prime example being back in March, I think, this year, that you crashed heavily and ended up fracturing your back. Is that just part of the nature of the sport, to expect some severe bumps and bruises along the way?
Yeah, well, it is an extreme sport at the end of the day, so, but you do get bumps and bruises, and, like, if you're unlucky, you'll get, like, a broken bone or something, but, you know, I always have that in my head, well, not, like, when I'm riding, but, like, I know that it's a dangerous sport, so that's why we do a lot of, like, safe training. Like, if we're learning a big trick, then we'll go somewhere where there's got an airbag or a foam pit to try it in first, so we'll never really try a trick before, you know, we can do it safely. And, you know, sometimes it does go wrong, or you know, we're unlucky. Like back in March, yeah, I fractured a vertebrae in my back, which was quite scary. Didn't really want to break my back this season, but luckily it was only minor, so I was back to snowboarding in only 6 weeks, which is really good, and I'm fully fit now. And I've had a couple of other broken bones in the past, and I snapped my ACL a few years ago, which was really bad. Like, that was 6 months of rehab, which sucked, but I always come back stronger because I'm determined, and I love snowboarding so much that little injuries like this like don't faze me, and I just come back stronger than I was before.
Yeah, that determined nature of your personality, I suppose, is quite important for that. But also, do you almost need to be fearless as well to be successful in that sport, so you don't subconsciously hold back in whatever trick you're doing?
In a way, yeah. Like, it's best to not be scared of what you're doing. And sometimes, you know, you do get scared because you're going into a jump at about 30, 40 miles per hour, like about to hit something that's bigger than a house. So it can be quite daunting at times. And I've just learned that if you're too scared to try something new, like because the jump's too big or you just don't feel like you're ready for it yet, then I go back to the stage before and I make sure that I've got that unlocked first, and then the more I do that, the easier that gets, and then eventually it becomes less scary and then you can try it. So I just like to do things as safely as possible so that I can prevent injuries.
Yeah, and when you say it's as big as a house, that really puts some sort of perspective on it, I think. But bumps and bruises aside, it's been quite a successful year for you, picking up your first X Games medal, an Air and Style podium, and of course becoming the first Brit to win a Snowboard Big Air World Cup. Can you put into words just how much you've enjoyed this season?
Oh, this has been like my best season yet, and you know, I'm so excited about how it's all gone. And like last season, that was the first like big season for me because I got my first ever like World Cup podium, and I didn't really know that I could top that this year. Like, I didn't have that in my head. I just knew that the Olympics is around the corner, so I just wanted to make sure I landed my runs and got into the final so that I could qualify for the Olympics. And then within like the second competition of the season, I podiumed at a World Cup, and I was really excited. And then it just kept getting better and better. Then I got bronze at the Olympic test event, which was a really big confidence booster because obviously that's competing against all the other people that are going to be in the Olympics, so I'm hoping I can bring back a medal after doing that. And then yeah, my X Games medal, that was definitely the highlight because before snowboarding was in the Olympics, X Games was always like the biggest event in action sports, and only 8 girls get invited, which that in itself is like a really big achievement, so to get a medal was just like amazing, and I'm really happy with that. And so yeah, it's been a good one. And then I got my first ever World Cup gold as well in Russia at the Big Air, and that was like a really, really cool feeling because I'd always wanted to win a World Cup, so I'm sure any athlete would. So yeah, I'm really proud of myself for that.
Absolutely, I'm sure a lot of other people are proud as well. And bearing that all in mind, you're still what, just 19 years age?
Yeah, I'm 19.
So is this then the level that you hoped you would be performing at this stage of your career? Have you almost surpassed your own expectations?
I haven't really thought about like how old I wanted to be, at what level. I just knew that I just had to keep progressing and pushing my own riding. And I think right now I'm at a really good stage in my career. Like, I feel like this is just a starting point, and I'm ranked second in the world at 19. So I'm hoping that I can improve on that, and I'm in a really good position because the girl ahead of me is like 26. So I've got like, I feel like I've got loads of years left in me to like progress and push my riding and better myself. So I'm really excited for like what the future brings.
Exactly. And I imagine there's a fair amount of travelling involved and globetrotting when you're competing, be it competitions or training camps. Is it easy enough or a bit of a challenge to jet around the globe a lot of the time?
Well, like, that is one of the good things about being a professional snowboarder, is that you get to travel the world and like snowboard in all these amazing places. And like, it's taken me places that I would never normally go to, like Russia and Korea. So it's been a really cool experience. But yeah, like, the travelling can get a bit much sometimes. Like this season especially, because we've been doing all the Olympic qualifiers, we've had to literally just do like back-to-back competitions like all season, and it's been really tiring at times. And at one point we had like a 2-week window where I literally went from Canada to Switzerland, back to America and Austria, So I was just going, like, back and forth across the country in, like, a space of 2 weeks. So my jet lag was, like, all over the place. And, yeah, it was really tough.
Yeah, certainly racking up those air miles. And I think of someone off the top of my head, someone like Heather Watson, the tennis player, who's admitted that she doesn't find it easy at all to compete away from home. Is that an important mindset, you think, that you need in order to be successful? That you can cope with being away from home a little bit more easier than other people can?
Yeah, definitely, because especially with snowboarding, like, we don't have any mountains in Britain, so we have to travel in order to do the competitions to train properly. But I feel like I'm lucky that I've got into the sport quite young, because I've been travelling since I was, like, 13 years old, and that really helps, because, like, now at 19 I'm used to it and I know what to expect, whereas, like, when I first started travelling I found it really hard, but I'm totally used to it now, and, like, I don't get homesick or anything, and, you know, it's like coming home is a holiday for me, so it's like, nice that I get the best of both worlds. I feel like snowboarding is purely abroad, and then coming home is, like, my break time, so, yeah, I think that I've been lucky that I'm used to it already.
Yeah, and speaking of home, I believe home for you is good old West Yorkshire, and there seems to be something in the water in Yorkshire, because there's a vast number of successful athletes that have come out of that area. Jessica Ennis-Hill, Alistair Brownlee, and Nicola Adams, to name just three. And one of the most astonishing stats that came out of the Rio 2016 Olympics is that Yorkshire would have finished 17th in the medal table if it was a country. Can you put your finger on it then? Why you Yorkshire lot do so well?
I'm not sure. I guess that we just have a lot of passion for what we do, and we try really hard. And also, like, for the snowboarding side of things, like, we only have, like, dry slopes and snow domes to train on, which, you know, we just go whenever we can, and we just, like, love it so much that we just keep going because we enjoy it, and then because we enjoy it, we end up learning and getting better. But, yeah, I guess we've just got a lot of passion there that keeps us going.
Absolutely. And you wrote a great column for the Metro newspaper about how you could kind of relax a bit next season, since your qualification for the Pyeongchang Olympics was effectively sorted. What will your preparation consist of between now and when the games start in February?
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased to be in the position I'm in now, because I did really well last season, which means that I'm ranked second in the world in, like, the leaderboards, and the top 30 girls get to go to the Olympics, so I'm quite safe. I mean, the official, like, announcement of who goes to the Olympics doesn't come out till January, but I think I'm pretty certain now. Like, I don't really think I could drop out the top 30, which is a really nice position to be in, because now I can just focus on training and learning new tricks and concentrating on, like, the things that I want to work on for the Olympics, whereas, like, last season it was just purely competitions. We didn't really have any time to train at all, so it's going to be really nice this season to, like, feel a little bit more relaxed going into Pyeongchang.
That certainly helps. And you mentioned, you know, working on things. What do you feel is the main aspect of your game that you think you need to improve on before the Olympics?
Well, I think that I'm going to need a double cork in my run, whereas, like, this season I didn't need it. I was just doing, like, flat spins, which, you know, it depends how well you do it. A spin could score more than a double cork, but I want to have both options in my run. So that's why we went to America last week to train on the airbag, so I could get my backside double cork 1080 more consistent. So I'm wanting to put that in my run for Pyeongchang, and I'm hoping that that'll really help me to secure a medal if I can land that there.
And a lot of the athletes I've spoken to in the past often tell me about how important the sports psychology nature of competitive action is for them, and, you know, sort of trying to stop any lingering self-doubt come in. Do you find that sports psychology and that mental side of the game easier to handle, or is it, you know, something that you think you can get better at with time?
I think I can definitely get better at it. Right now, I think my main, like, things that I struggle with mentally when I snowboard is, like, being nervous at competitions. But I'm sure everyone goes through that, but it'd be nice to like feel not as nervous like when I'm about to drop in, but I try and control that, and my coach has helped me as well, like to make sure that if we're about to like drop in and I've got like 10 riders ahead of me before I go, I keep my mind busy, so they'll keep me like walking about and, you know, jumping about to keep them, to keep me warm and not like focusing so much until like I'm about to drop in, which that's really helped season, like, which it's proved that it's worked as well, so I'm just going to keep working on things like that.
And you mentioned your coaches there, and I imagine there's a lot of people behind the scenes, not just coaches, but teammates and friends as well, that have helped you and pushed you. How important have they been for your own personal development?
Well, they've been, like, so important to me. Like, my coach, Hamish McKnight, he's taught me, like, so much and improved my riding loads. And, yeah, like, people like that definitely helped me become the rider that I am today. And then you need your friends as well. Like, we've got a really, really good team at the minute. We've got really good riders and people behind the scenes, like the physios and, you know, like the second coaches and things like that. And you really need them, because having a strong team behind you going to these competitions is really important to help your confidence as well. Because if you're feeling sad or you're, like, nervous, then you've got all these people to like help people lift your spirits and keep your confidence high.
And with the sport itself, I suppose I can widen this out to a lot of other winter sports as well, because I suppose traditionally Britain haven't done as well at Winter Olympics as we have at Summer Olympics, and we only won our first medal on snow in 2014. How do you think your sport has progressed and grown in the country over the last few years, and is it, you know, continuing on an upward trajectory?
Yeah, definitely. It's progressed so much, and I think that the Olympics in 2014 helped massively, because that was the first year that slopestyle was in the Olympics. So I think that really, like, a lot of people would see that for the first time and were really interested in it and thought it was really amazing to watch, which it is, but they might not have seen it before, which is now, like, it's come into, like, the public eye and people want to try snowboarding, and especially because Jenny Jones got the bronze medal there, and she's just shown that even though you've come from a country where we have no mountains like everyone else that we compete against, like, we can still get a medal at the Olympics, which, you know, it's an inspiration to most people, and now we've got, like, more funding on the back of how well we've been doing, so that helps loads as well. So now we've got, like, more pathways for younger riders coming up, and so they can go on, like, more camps and get more help to progress their riding. And as on the main team, we get to, like, travel to different places and use better facilities than we would before, which helps massively, because right now snowboarding's progressing so fast, especially in the women's side, so we have to, like, keep up with the game and make sure that we're always a little bit ahead, which, you know, that's because of 2014, that's helped us so much now going into 2018 and all the Olympics after that.
Now, that's just something else that's been echoed by some other athletes I've interviewed, is how important that funding is to really help grow the sport. And how vital has that been for your own development? And can you imagine where you'd be without that backing?
It is so vital. I mean, personally, you know, when you're doing all these World Cups, it is expensive for the flights and the accommodation. So having the funding from the UK sport, it's, like, amazing. It just, like, eases that little bit of pressure of, like, can I afford it? Because then we can go and train, like, confidently. And we even get access to, like, other camps that we wouldn't get access to before now, because, like, they've been too expensive. But we can now train at these facilities as well. And UK Sport bought us a Super Tramp, which is the only one in Britain, and that's up in Glasgow. And that's basically, like, two Olympic-sized trampolines, like, put together, but into one, so it's, like, really bouncy, and we can then practice, like, tricks that we do on a snowboard on that when we're not abroad. So, you know, we've got all these other facilities now that have helped my riding a lot, which is, like, really cool.
Yeah, that's always good to hear. But with the increased success that you've obviously been having, and I'm sure you've found this out to an extent already, there comes increased interest in you as a person from the media and the outside world. Is that a strange feeling that you're now becoming a highly recognisable name?
It is a little bit strange. I mean, the other day I was just at the gym and someone asked me for my autograph, which I've never had before, so that was quite funny. But, yeah, it's definitely becoming, like, more well-known now in, like, the mainstream media, which is really good for snowboarding and for everyone on the team. And so, yeah, I think that it's going to be really cool. But personally, like, I've been kind of used to it because I tried to go to the 2014 Olympic Games. So they kind of, like, started giving me media training back then, and I had a lot of interviews around going to the Olympics. So I'm really glad that I went through all that then, so that I feel way more experienced now going into 2018, and I don't feel as, like, pressured with all the media because I'm kind of used to it. So I'm really happy that I did that back then to make it easier for me now.
Exactly. I'm sure a lot of that added experience, I suppose, really helps when people like myself come along trying to ask you all manner of questions.
Yeah, definitely.
And out of interest, have you ever Googled yourself?
No, not in a while, actually, no.
That's all right. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more publicity to come out about you and with the upcoming Olympics as well, because I know hopes are certainly high for what you can do at those games. And are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I mean, especially with how last season went and getting the medal at the test event, I'm just, like, really looking forward to it. And I'm feeling really confident with my own riding as well, which is good. So I just kind of want to get there, and hopefully I can land my best run and get a medal. So I'm just going to keep training from now until then. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
And past Olympians I've also interviewed have mentioned how unique the Olympic Games are, in, you know, because the spectacle is obviously huge and it's not really comparable with a lot of other events. Do you think you can be ready for that mayhem and being an athlete right at the centre when there's this massive amount of talent all around you?
Yeah, I think some of my friends have already, like, warned me about what it's like, and they really enjoyed it. They said, like, it's a surreal experience and that I'm going to really enjoy it. I think that'll be okay, and especially because, like, you already know all the snowboarders and the skiers in freestyle, so it's just going to be like being at another competition with everybody there, except there's also going to be all the other sports people there from other sports. So it's going to be really exciting, and I think it'll be really cool. I don't think the pressure will get to me because I'm looking forward to it too much.
That's always a good thing. And we're all looking forward to it as well. I'm sure it's going to be a great event. And with that, I suppose we better wrap up. And I just want to thank you once again, Katie, for taking some time out to speak to us. It's been lovely having you on, and we wish you all the very best in the run-up to the Games and at the Games themselves. So make sure there's no more injuries in the process. Many thanks and all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Katie for taking the time out to chat to us in that really interesting interview. And we'll just take this opportunity to remind everyone that you can follow us on social media. We're at SportSpielPod, that's Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. And you can also email us feedback at sportsspielpod@gmail.com.
You'll have noticed we've had some really high calibre athletes in the last few weeks. A World Cup winner in Marley Packer, you've got an up-and-coming rising star, Katie Ormerod, you know. We've got a lot more exciting stuff in the pipeline. So Sammy Kinghorn, obviously, I can't forget Sammy.
Yes.
There's a lot more, so yeah, make sure keep listening, pass on the message, you know. We love to get new people listening, and even if they're not interested in sport, you know, it's great to listen to some of these athletes who have some fantastic stories and will become headline names one day.
Exactly. So spread the word, everyone. Tell your parents, tell your friends, subscribe on iTunes, and until next time, have fun.